excuse me, I prepared a five-minute talk about Laurie's work, which I was following literally from 1973 or 74. Laurie Anderson's narrative often begins with her own journeys and those of mythic Americans, such as Melville's Ahab in Pursuit of Moby Dick. She has a knack of giving the most personal stories a compelling national, cosmic, and spiritual dimension. Situated in the present moment, they open up to the future, as in the work United States, one of the monuments of 1970s art, indeed, of American culture. It is a seven-hour compilation of visual imagery, vernacular language, and music, that is, talking songs, which sample jazz, rock and roll, and reggae. United States' aspiration was, as Laurie said, to examine, quote, America by talking about herself, end quote. The stories she tells are intimate, even as they suggest larger social, political, historical, philosophical, and spiritual issues. Put another way, she took autobiographical incidents and made them personify the American experience, much as Whitman did in I Hear America Singing. I believe that Laurie's essential spirituality is found in her vision of the United States as having a spiritual purpose or on being on the move to a spiritual destiny. This vision inspired our earliest settlers, the Pilgrims and the Puritans in the 17th century, who were on the move across the Atlantic Ocean to what they thought of as a new world in which they would establish a new Eden based on the Word of God. Then in the 18th and 19th centuries, pioneers intent on freedom and free land were on the move into successive Western frontiers, many guided by spiritual visions. And in the 20th and 21st centuries, astronauts have been on the move into outer space, perhaps not for spiritual reasons, but pointing to the next move, which is beyond. The open road through the Western prairie of the past foretold the transcontinental highways of today and their imagined trajectory into the new worlds of outer spaces. Conestoga wagons gave way to trains and automobiles and now rockets. It is fitting that in her performances, Laurie has traversed the oceans with Ahab and outer space with the astronauts. United States begins with an automobile driver asking for directions. Quote, hello, excuse me, can you tell me where I am, end quote. Where is the where? A future America, inner existential space, outer space, spiritual space. The narrative moves in and out of these questions and the spaces they suggest. Who is asking the question? The Pilgrims, the Puritans, the trailblazers of the Western Plains, astronauts, modern man, postmodern man. Laurie embraces them all. Her gloss on America's spiritual purpose is announced in the first paragraph of United States, and I'll end with this quote. Laurie writes, quote, a certain American religious sect has been looking at conditions of the world during the flood. According to their calculations, pre-flood civilization would be somewhere up in the area of upstate New York, and the Garden of Eden roughly in New York City. Laurie concludes that, quote, there are no traces of biblical history in the upstate New York area, or we are led to the only available conclusion in this time warp, and that is that the Ark has simply not left yet. The message in this text is that the United States is still at the beginning of its national mission. Laurie laments our failures, but remains hopeful. Me too. Thank you.
serving. Is this on? I guess it is. There's so many things. You know, we've been thinking about your work so much, and I have so many questions. One of them, of course, has to do with your grandmother, but I think I'm going to eschew that for a minute because I was thinking about this project. And one of the questions I was thinking about, and I want to read this quote that you cited somewhere. It's a Melville quote. It's not from Moby Dick. You probably remember it. And I'd like to ask you later where it's from because I couldn't find it. The quote is, "In all human beings lie hidden and marvelous properties, which when they are accidentally brought together, manage to reveal themselves." Do you remember that quote? So beautiful. So I'm thinking about the hidden, you know, moving from an unseen or an unperceived world to be revealed. And then I started thinking about, you know, your work brings and coaxes images, voices, characters forward from invisibility to visibility and creates a setting for them to reveal themselves. And certainly the garden is a perfect example of that. So I'm also thinking of the performances, the way images slide and shift and disappear and come back, shadows. There's a lot here. The question is, there's a question here somewhere, and Mark, I think, might add to it. You know, how do you think about that, say, that transmission, that movement between the visible and the invisible and back? That's a question. And Mark, do you want to add something to that? We're going to make it really complicated. Yeah,
I mean, there's another side to this I want to raise. But in this context, what I'd like to do is go back to a comment that you made about the role of the artist, and that is to try to learn to see things the way they are. The whole relationship between the visible and the invisible is complicated because sometimes that which is invisible is that which is most apparent in certain ways. And so the question of what's hiding and what's showing is not necessarily, so there are ways in which this whole problematic to see things the way they are may be to see what is most obvious, which is that which is least visible in certain ways. So the whole problem of the visible and the invisible and how that works itself out and plays itself out in your art.
Well, to start right there with that, as on an historical note, I was asked to come to the New York Public Library to look at anything in their collection. And they said, just pick some things. And then they sent, you know, like 7,000 things that they had. And it was, you know, I wanted to look at absolutely everything there. I ended up looking at the Declaration of Independence, mostly because one of my hobbies as a child was writing and designing and producing colonial newspapers. I know, sounds really geeky. Did anyone else have that hobby? I mean, I think it was probably some art project that kids had at that time, you know, to what was going on in your small town. But on my way out of the library, I went through a beautiful exhibition. I'm not sure it's still there now, but a kind of timeline of three major religions in the world. And I was really struck by one little thing that was a year 4000 BC, Abraham declares that there is one invisible God. And that was a moment that was actually, you know, on a timeline, which was, I was really struck with that because this, especially with the invisible aspect of that desert God discovery. But with your comment about immateriality, too, that is a section in Moby Dick on it's about alchemy and properties. And
this is in Moby Dick.
Yeah, what are the properties of man? And it culminates in a question which is, I find, the central question of Moby Dick, which is, what is a man if he outlives the lifetime of his God? And it's from that. I found that was so central to that book that when I was working on this opera called Songs and Stories from Moby Dick, and by the way, another hint for you young artists, never do that. Yeah, it's just such a burden in a way. I mean, I fell in love with this novel, and I thought, I just heard music, and I heard the whiteness of the whale, and just wanted to write songs and things and do an homage to this great work of art. in the end, it was so intimidating to do that because I kept thinking, is this really fair to Melville? And also, I live in a neighborhood where he lived and worked for some of his life, and I thought, you know, his ghost is, he's going to come and find me and kill me. You know, it's like, this doesn't necessarily have to be a work of a multimedia opera. You know, it's perfectly good as a book, you know. And so I was spent a lot of time being sort of terrified by that idea, also because I had, while I was working on this, Melville's Bible. A friend, when he said he heard that I was working on this, he said, I got something for you. He brought a big box over, and inside was Melville's Bible that he had while he was writing Moby Dick. So I took it out. I was like, whoa. And it was really, I had it for many months. And, of course, my friend had bought the Bible at Sotheby's, and he had taken it to the FBI and said, you know, because it was full of pencil marks. And he said, I want to find out what they were. And they'd been erased by his wife, not an ideal relationship, let's say. You're marking up the family Bible. How could you? So she had erased everything. So he took it to the FBI, and they said, you know, well, if it had been done like 100 years ago, maybe we could see what had been erased, but 150, no, it's starting to like fluff back up. And so I spent quite a lot of time with the Bible, the magnifying glass, looking through every page, you know, for some Leviathan mention or whatever, and I found one in Isaiah that he had circled many times with stars and arrows, and Isaiah 23 something. Anyway, it was about that piercing serpent, that something serpent of the sea. In other words, he was talking about Leviathan, the whale, as the snake, and the ocean was his garden. So I thought it was very clearly his, giant metaphor. But I also, so that was a kind of tantalizing thing to have. But also, one of the other things about that book, about Moby Dick, was that I found in looking at its history, was that the first draft of it had no Ahab in it at all, which really struck me as, like, you know, what that meeting with the editor might have been, you know, just going like, it's a great book, Herman, but, you know, it is kind of like, guys go fishing, you know, a lot of interesting things are happening here, but there's no motor. What are you doing this for? Where is this going? What's it about? You know, why don't you get it like a crazy captain? So who appears, and not until midway in the book, because he wasn't in the book before that, he's hiding hiding under the stack of papers, is the other book that Melville was reading at the same time, Shakespeare, King Lear, outstocks an American Lear with a kind of English accent. Strike to the mast! And these American guys are going, who's this? Is he the captain? And why does he have this crazy English accent? You know, so it was the development of that book also was something I tried to put into the commentary that I was doing.
Another angle on this, Mike. I want to try to get an intersection or some of the Protestant background that you had. You mentioned the Abraham story. But also your fascination with Buddhism and the problem of nothingness. Through the issue of silence and the role of silence in your work, I sometimes teach a course called Nothing, and one of the questions I ask the class the first day is, what color is silence? You've said somewhere that there's no such thing as digital silence. So, I mean, invisibility, whiteness, void. What about silence?
Well, I think my first introduction to meditation was really through feeling very scattered. And a friend of mine said, well, I said, I'm really feeling scattered. I can't seem to focus on something. He said, well, I did this meditation, and it was a Vipassana meditation, which is one of the newer forms of Buddhism, 500 years old, coming from Thailand. And he said, after I did these 2 weeks of silence, I could focus my mind, like I got rid of the chatter, and I could just go and then move it over here and move it over there. And I said, that's for me. So I went there to do 2 weeks of silence. And the first thing they said was, you're here because you're in pain. And I said, no, I'm not. I feel fine. I'm here to focus my mind. And they said, no, you're here because you're in pain. I said, no. Anyway, it wasn't a good start to this thing. And, but I did gradually realize that the focus of this way, which was a, based on the premise that when something bad happens and you don't scream, you put it somewhere. And you put it in a very elegantly coded way in your body. And to retrieve that, it is not the talking cure of Freud, of let's talk the story back to its beginning and just find where it started, and then you can see why and get rid of it. No, but it was based on physicality, which I really appreciated and could understand better than telling a story about where your pain came from, and didn't work for me particularly. So I found, so that when you do this meditation, you wake up at 4, you meditate for a couple of hours, you have some breakfast, then you meditate for 5 hours, then you take a little walk, then you have your one meal of the day, you meditate for 7 more hours, then you walk again, and you know, it's, and at the end of this 2 weeks, you know, no one says anything. So you gradually realize that as your left arm feels like it's going to fall off, that part of that experience is an emotion, a specific one. So, and you realize that things are coded. So you put loneliness in your knee. You put loss in your shoulder. In the back of your neck, you put anger. You know, and it's all, of course, the negative emotions, because the positive ones just flow through you, and you're like, whoops, you don't need to hang on to them, you know, they're free. And so it was that coding that was fascinating to me, along with a number of things that happen when you spend that amount of time in silence, and also in without much visual stimulation, is that when you do come back into the world, you have this very increased peripheral vision, for one thing. That was the first thing I noticed, that it wasn't about, you were very aware of what's happening over here, and that as much is happening behind you as in your field of vision, and it wasn't about this vision of desire, I see it, I want it, I get it, I look at it. It was much more of a sense of where you were in a room and in a world, so that you were surrounded in this ocean of air. So for me, silence had to do with a lot of things, particularly pain and focus. So
I'd like to get back to invisibility for a moment, because it seems to fit. I'd like to get back to invisibility for a moment, because it seems to flit in and out of many of your works. And I guess if one thinks of the immaterial as possibly being spiritual, then invisibility is pretty invisible. I just like to quote this from one of your works. You talk about Duchamp's dictum, that since three-dimensional objects cast two-dimensional shadows, three-dimensional objects must be the shadows of four-dimensional objects. And then you conclude, we can safely assume that the shadow cast by a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional object must be one-dimensional. That is, it must be pure idea. And I, when I wrote this down, I thought of the line in the Bible, St. John 1, line 1, in which he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. And what's more invisible than a word? But the idea of invisibility, I wonder if you would comment on that, Lori.
First of all, that quote, was, isn't it great to be an art student? You could say stuff like that. Sure, that it goes down from
the show at Artist
Space. Yeah, you know. Oh,
that's 74.
You know, sometimes I think I do idealize that time for many reasons. One is that it wasn't about branding, which so much of culture is about now, branding yourself, getting your brand, getting your Facebook thing, getting your whole thing, you know. And for me, invisibility was much more, you know, was the way to go. And I really loved feeling invisible. And also, much of my work, I feel, is being a spy. And you have to be not there to be doing that, you know. And of course, what kind of spy would say, I'd like to be a spy, you know. What an idiot, you know, deep cover. Anyway, I don't know particularly why invisibility is equated with spirituality, because it just, when things are gone, you know, I don't necessarily, and also when I see living things that are very material and very, they're living, breathing things, to me, they're the most spiritual things you can look at, you know, there they are, you know, in this miraculous shape. And so when they're invisible, I'm not sure that this, you know, invisible Abraham God, it makes the same impression on me. And because it's I like the tangible. On the other hand, I don't particularly believe that we're here right now at all. I'm not sure at all that we're here and that you're here, that I'm here. I think we're probably not. So that said, and that's really something I do actually believe, that this is some kind of very odd dream. I mean, I'm really enjoying it, much of it, you know. But I don't. I really do see it as a dream.
I'm convinced that I'm here because I've just realized how much anger I have in my neck. I want to be sort of concrete for a minute because biography is interesting and it comes up, you know, when we're from the same part of the world. In Illinois, so I think about that a little bit. But you know, in reading about your grandmother, right, who was an evangelical preacher, and you attended Billy Graham crusades and all that, and you know, looking at performances, having seen some live and seen in various venues, you know, electronically and so forth, you know, I think about a evangelical, the great ones anyway. You know, they're mesmerizing, they're seductive. And how do you figure all that into, how do you think that works its way out in some of the performances that you do? Do you think about it directly? Or?
There was good singing in it, and I was very attracted to that, something that makes you sing. And the thing that I felt about her, this is a grandmother who was the Pentecostal, you know, missionary, and she was, and I watched her very carefully, actually, you know, what she was doing, because it seemed very heartfelt and completely absurd. So, for example, she went to Japan to convert Buddhists to, you know, Southern Baptists, see? But she didn't really bother to learn.
That's where the Buddhism comes from.
Yeah, yeah. She didn't bother to learn Japanese, you know, so she would just sing hymns, and they'd like, wah, da, da. And hope that they would get the idea of something. I don't know. It was a complete failure. But what was successful in that exercise was that she was a very vain Southern lady, and made homemade hats that were huge concoctions of, you know, feathers and veils and grapes and, you know, just things, crown-like things, really, big crowns. And the Japanese saw those and were like, yo, how do you make those? And she taught them how to make those hats. And they taught, she was a gardener. She was a loved roses, and she saw the bonsai cutting methods. And they taught her to cut bonsai style, and that was the exchange. And that was enough. You know, that's a lot. That's a hat for a rose. You know, it's a lot. And if you really try to change somebody's mind about something like that, It's just, first of all, it's really insulting to the other person, and then it's just absurd, you know. And so I watched her try to do that, and really understood some things about what you can change about yourself, and what's really very difficult to change.
Wow. After that comment, there's a question I want to ask you. You invoked the category of the spy a minute ago, which is an interesting category. Kierkegaard is one of my favorite philosophers, always described himself as a spy in the service of a higher good. He's known, of course, as the melancholy Dane, fear and trembling, concept of dread and everything. Nonetheless, he's one of the first to really understand the importance of irony, more particularly humor. And he says at one point that the form of awareness that most closely approximates religious faith is humor. So I'd like to hear you think a little bit about the role of humor in your work. There is, of course, in the West, well, there's a long tradition of humor in Zen, of course, and different traditions, the holy fool. But it also seems to me that there's sort of a trickster element to some of the work that you do. And so the role of how you see humor in your work.
Well, first I'll tell you a joke that sort of backfired. You know, I was doing a lot of shows that in places that weren't really made to do shows. So museums, and sometimes they would say, why don't you do this in a church? Often in Italy, I was doing things in churches, which is very odd, because there you are on the altar with your stuff, with your keyboards, and right behind you is a crucifix, a bloody crucifix. So in Berlin, I made an extremely tasteless joke during this show, and here's the joke. So why is it a good thing that Jesus was born in New Testament times instead of Old Testament times? And the answer is that in Old Testament times, death was by stoning, and that in New Testament times, death was by crucifixion. And so instead of people doing this, they would all be doing this. You know, which would have changed a lot of things about architecture, and, you know, you wouldn't have the ground plan. It would be all more strewn around and just chaotic. Anyway, that didn't go over in Berlin, especially, you know, in the context of the church and all of that. Gloominess appeals to me, and Kierkegaard in particular. So I guess that's the thing that's the most irritating about things when you talk about spiritual or religious things, is nothing's funny. You know, and so much of life is just hilarious. It's just ridiculous. And to cut that off is to cut off, you know, your arms. So when things have to become so serious, and same in culture, you know, it's just when you have the official culture and what it's supposed to mean, and, you know, it really is, it can become very, very, very dry and humorless and just kind of market-driven, just hysterical sort of exercise of things. And nobody stops to go, this is ridiculous, you know. So
maybe I have just one real quick one. Angels. Go.
Angels.
I mean, you have dark angels, gravity angels, strange angels. You have Walter Benjamin's angels. You know, it comes up. And, you know, you've used it a lot as a metaphor or as an active image, I should say. Is there something particular that you want to...
Well, it was a metaphor, because it was really just a way to say, you know, that we are the angels. Because I don't actually believe in angels. But I do believe that we are them. And so in writing all of those things about that, I was hoping that would sort of seep through.
Irving, do you have something?
Lurie, in my day, which was just after the Peloponnesian Wars, we used to think that high art is high art and low art is low art and never the twain shall meet. I know you've been asked this question a lot of time, but you actually did the crossover, where you maintained your status very much in the high art world and yet appealed to literally masses of all sorts of people who probably never even stepped into a museum. Would you talk now about what your attitude to your role in this was?
One of the things that I did really like about, for example, the commercial world was that it didn't have a lot of the snobbery of in terms of what you're making. So when I was making something, I didn't want to put it in the so-called art market, which is increasingly what you would call the art world. It's a friend of mine has said, you know, I just realized I don't live in the art world. I live in the art market, and I just thought that's what it has happened to it. And I played my small part in making that happen, I suppose. But one of the things that I found interesting about, for example, making records was that they were cheap, and that you could just sell them. Now, I also came into that sort of backwards, just because I didn't have a goal of making records, for example. It just I made one, and I was on a small grant, and I liked doing records. It was a lot of fun to do, and people would call me up, and this is the way it worked. They would call me up, and they'd say, I'd like to order a record. I'd say, okay, get a record, wrap it up, and walk to the post office. That's how distribution worked. Then one day with that record, Oh Superman, I got a call from London. They said, we'd like to order some records. I said, great. How many do you need? They said, 40,000 by Thursday and 40,000 more on Monday. I was like, okay, I'll be right back to you. Click, you know. So people at Warner Brothers who had wanted me to do a record, and I said, I don't want to do, it's just pop culture. I don't really, you know, I'm a snob. I don't like, that's not the world. I called them up and said, listen, can you manufacture some records for me? And they said, that's not the way we do things at Warner Brothers Records and tapes. You know, you sign an 8 contract thing. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll do that. And I got a lot of grief from other artists at that time. They were like, you just sold out. What are you doing? That's the art world is this and the commercial world is that. And I was like, and then a year later, it had that tag of crossover artist, and then everyone was like crossing over, like, this is good, rowing over there, you know. So I think that one of the things that I find kind of really scary about the world now is what we were talking about before, is this, commercialization of kind of everything. One of my favorite books now is called Reality Capitalism, and basically the premise of this is that it's more people can imagine the end of the world than can imagine the end of capitalism. And that, to me, is really hairy. And even though the other systems that were alternative systems, state, you know, they were nightmares as well. Stalinism, communism didn't work so well either. But now there is, unlike then, there is no other model. It's just get what you can and just go out there and just, you know. And everyone's got a dollar sign hanging over their head. What are you worth? And you know, any party you go to, you know, you feel the assignment of worth. You know, I can't talk to you because that other one is worth more over there. What are you doing to your? What are we doing to ourselves? You know, that it's just truly frightening. And then it goes into personal branding, in which you are becoming your own product, you know, conspiring in that as well to become a commodity. So
we want to open up. There's one last really brief question I can't resist asking you. Are mountains aware?
Yes. Yes, they are.
There it is. Okay, we have a microphone, and I guess we have arms. So Daisy will walk around if you have a question. And
it's hard for us to see up here because of the light.
So I think we can handle it from down there. Questions for Lori?
Yes, some lights would be great. Oh, thanks.
Oh, hello. All right, I guess it's me. Hi. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your beginnings as a violinist, and as I can only assume from what says in the bio, in youth orchestra, being classically trained, and how that has maybe influenced or shaped any of your work, specifically musically.
I started as a kid playing the violin, and then played a lot until I was 16, and then at that point realized that I was going to have to practice all the time to keep up, and that I would never learn anything else, that I would never learn German, I would never learn physics, and I would just be practicing. And so I stopped completely, and then now much later, I still don't know German, and I still don't know physics. And I'm kind of a mediocre violin player, but, you know, it's the thing about that was I began making my own violins and trying to see what I could make them do, and to sing like a violin was really my goal. Last week I had something really ridiculous happen. I was getting some kind of electronic music award, and so I wanted to do something having to do with electronic music, and so I dug out an old thing that I used to use with, which was a pillow speaker. And these are the little speakers that you use to, you know, you put in your pillow and you, like, learn German in your sleep kind of thing. That did not work for me. I just woke up feeling super paranoid, you know, just, ah. And so because I like putting things in electronics into my mouth, I just get a kind of thrill out of that. I recorded violin and would just put it in my mouth and you hear, you could control certain pitches and volume by doing that. Okay, so I dragged that out to this award thing, and I was just practicing in the afternoon. And the speaker was a little bit old, and the speaker fluid and glue had leaked out of the speaker. And I put it in my mouth, and I glued my tongue to the roof of my mouth. I don't know if you've ever done that. It was like, I was supposed to give a speech, you know, I was like... Plus, I was sure that the roof of my mouth was melting from, you know, all of the stuff. I thought, it's disappearing. So, you know, I went to this is in Atlanta, I went to a pharmacist, and I said, and apparently, this is not the first time someone had glued one part to another, you know, and she gave me this concoction, just put it in your mouth, and it did work, so it, unglued the thing, but the biological and the electronic are really, it's really fascinating to me how those things work. And so when I began to make my own violins, it was a way to make those instruments more human and electronics, and bring in some of the components that we have that are somewhat electronic ourselves, our speed and our memories, and to kind of make these hybrid instruments.
Laura, you were not only a student here, but you did some teaching at Columbia as well, didn't you?
Not Columbia, but I did some at three places, really briefly. I was a teacher.
Your academic career wasn't, I understand, a great success.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. So that, I would say that's an understatement, because I was teaching Egyptian architecture and Assyrian sculpture at various places, Staten Island Community College, Pace, and somewhere else, night school, because I decided not to get up at all for a year until I had a good idea, or really felt like getting up, because I didn't want to, you know, just... So this night, I was taught at night, so it was really... worked well with that plan. I was not keeping up with the Egyptological journals, let's say. And so these slides would come up, and I would just draw a complete blank. I just... didn't remember one thing about that image. So it was a dark, you know, in the dark, and I would just make things up. You know, students would write it all down, and then I would test them on it, you know. That's the way it worked. And so the following year, so that's why the career was like a year, because it cycled around to the next year, and they'd say, well, Miss Anderson said about that pyramid, and they're, what? You know? So, you know, plus I felt guilty about it as well. You know, I felt, you know, history is, you know, of course it's a lot about speculation, but really, you know, up to a certain point, you're making it up, of course you are, but to the extent that I was doing it, maybe not, and so I quit, and but not before I was fired. Super close, really close, just like that.
More questions?
Hi, over here. So you were talking a lot about narrative. That came up a lot in the discussion. And I was wondering if you can kind of speak to the importance of narrative in spirituality and if that might contradict with what you're saying about seeing the world as it is, since we kind of construct narrative.
To the extent that narrative is time and how we move through it, it seems to me that that major religions almost are there to explain that before they would explain how to be good. And so all those the stories of major religion, where did we come from? What will happen in the end? How does this story unfurl? Who made it? Where are we going? You know, it's a big narrative. So if you kind of accept one of those, oh, we came from this and we're going there. How do we move through time is I think what is answered by many of those big stories and myths. So I think probably what appeals to me most about Buddhism is those are very, very minimized, and that we're never going to find out where we came from, never. And we're never going to find out where we're going. Never. We don't know where we came. We're just going to. They're going to be stories. So, the most important thing, the only thing, is this exact moment that we're in right now, not the one that we were just in, or the one that we is going to be so much better over there, but only this one. And so, that's what to me is really moving about meditation, is that frightening and fantastic feeling of this is all there is. That's it. You know?
Many of your ideas are related to those of John Cage.
Yeah.
In the desire to live in the reality of the moment and appreciate the reality. It's a very optimistic outlook. Did his thinking actually have an influence on you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as many artists of my generation, it was like really key. And I think it was John Adams who recently said that something that really rang a bell for me is that it's not Cage's music, because if you listen to 433 or any of the music, it's like, you know, it was a mistake to call it that. It's really a philosophy, not music. So what does it feel like to spend 4 minutes and 33 seconds in so-called silence, of course, which he did not really believe in that there could be anything like that in any case. So many of the pieces that he left as a musician, you know, are kind of unlistenable, a lot of them. You know, you wouldn't sit down for an enjoyable evening to listen to those things. But as ideas, they open giant doors, you know.
You spoke a little bit about increasing kind of marketization and commercialization in modern life, and I just wondered to what extent you see a connection between that and possibly science and technology moving into to occupy a space that's left by a decline in religion and possibly the role of art in kind of reasserting a role for spirituality in life.
I'm not sure I grasped the whole heard it so well, but commerciality and religion and their how commerciality affects religion.
Well, the thought was that perhaps commercialization and science and technology are kind of moving in to occupy a space that's been left by religion, by the decline in religion and spirituality generally, and whether arts has a role in kind of reintroducing the notion of spirituality.
I don't know. I don't know that, because I think that you can find it so many places. You know, when I was at NASA, you know, I thought, they're already building giant artworks. The Stairway to Space is a giant artwork of, you know, it's nanotubes, biology, that, you know, it electronics that grows like biology, Jack and the Beanstalk stuff, you know, in which it has a beauty and incredible uselessness and poetry that are, you know, and form in a content that can't be pulled apart. All the great things that I not that I know what art is, I really don't, but when I see something like that, I think that has many things that look like a lot like art, as well as ways to imagine vast amounts of time, which I also find a very artful, you know, work of conceptual art. You go into a NASA Greening of Mars session, and the whiteboard stretches around, you know, acres of room. It's the 10,000-year timeline that they're working on for this project of the Greening of Mars, because we're going to go somewhere. And it's probably Mars, and so we're adding, of course, like air and water and terraforming it, because now that we know so much about taking care of planets, we're going to take care of Mars. Anyway, we're probably going to go there. I think it's a really fascinating thing that you're mentioning about the. How science and technology and religion are interacting. I mean, we're just feathering, touching on so much of this great idea for a series. I mean, in many ways, I think when I look around, I think something's really wrong here, you know, and it has in my mind something to do with commercialization and technology, and of course the fact that everyone is looking down during dinner doing this, and everyone's so lonely, you know, and feeling so cut off, and like, what are you making this for who, you know, and I think that that's actually an old thing, but it's also a very new thing, the way it's expressing itself now in terms of people who are extremely stressed out by the parade of items that you're supposed to get and keep getting, by the amount of information that comes in. I mean, I don't know if, I'm sure that you all feel this way too, is just emails, is just like, it's flowing, it won't stop. It just won't stop. And if you stop doing it for a second, it piles up. And plus you can't get lost anymore. Where are you going to go? There's nowhere to just leave. It's a giant trap, and I think people really feel this pressure of and a lot of it is technology. A lot of people I know are getting address books and calendar, paper calendars, and people who are super tapped in, I've just noticed, have gone, you know what? It just went over the border for me. I can't do that anymore. It's making me into something that I don't even recognize as myself. It's just, I'm working all the time. I'm so exhausted. I don't know why I'm doing this. You know, I'm on this treadmill that is going, for what? You know, you're good. You've answered all your email. Good for you. You know, it's like, but... Are you having anything like a good time? I mean, this sounds kind of shallow, but I really think that we're here not to have a bad time. I think we're here to have a really, really, really good time. A good time, you know. And so how do you have a good time? What is it like keeping up with this stuff? you know, when you do realize that the pressure of that our culture puts on us to be good citizens, i.e. consumers, it is truly frightening. I mean, one of the things my favorite book in the whole world right now is by a guy named Tom Hodgkinson called How to Be Idle. It's a fantastic book that just asks you questions like, hey, what about convalescence? You know, you're not supposed to, like, do that now. If you're just supposed to, like, if you get sick, pop a pill, work through it. That's the ethic, you know, work through it. And he said, well, what about the doctors that said, you know, when you feel better, then you go to a nice southern place and don't think and don't do anything for 4 months. You know, that's like a foreign concept. You know? He also then, because he's a British writer, has a different angle on it, and he would cite a British headline that says something like, Britain lost 500 million man-hours to illness this year. And he goes, since when did you owe Britain 500 million man-hours of yours? Who are you working for? What are you doing this for? You know, and there's just so many assumptions in our culture about how to do stuff, how to be good. You know, he just said, and then his central question is, you know, who taught you that, you know, in order to be a good person, you had to be a productive one, a worker. Who taught you that, and why do you think that? It's a daring and beautiful book. He wrote a follow-up on liberty. And it's truly breathtaking. I've read both books like 3 times, because trying to get it to sink in what that means. And he says very simple things like, at the end of each, start a guild would be one. And you have to think, what would it mean for me to start a guild in my own world? You know, in other words, don't work with these mega monsters, with the mega things. Think of how you could do it yourself. How would you reinvent this if you didn't choose to work in a big system? So what would it mean to you? So we're kind of doing a month of events at the Stone down to, Avenue C and 2nd Street, concerts every night. But then on Sundays, we have invited people to talk about topics like this. In particular, not artists talking about where I get my ideas, no. But people who come in and talk about, for example, Henry is going to come and talk about boilers. He's a boiler expert in New York, and he does tours of buildings with great boilers. And so you can come and learn about that. There's another person who taught our dog to play the piano, and she's talking about music and animals. And anyway, it's just a kind of effort to make a grassroots place where it's based on Alain de Botton's School of Life in London, where you go into this place. 20 books are out, and each one of those books, you go, I should read that. That's great. And that's okay, great. And then it's just about people coming in who just, everybody has a fascinating hour to say, at least, you know. So it features that kind of way of teaching people. Check it out next time you're in London. It's on one of these very obscure, like, Bruised Lamb's Ear Lane kind of is the name of the street. I don't know. And it's just a small place, but it's a really, I think, a great effort to look at how to learn things in a very different way, you know, and how to just reinvent the things that you do and the ways that you relate to the world.
You have one back there, Emily?
Hi, Lori. You spoke earlier about the sort of odd experience of being the artist in NASA, the artist in residence there, and that it seemed odd at first for you, but you came to see many connections between scientists and artists. And I'm thinking back to an earlier album of yours, The Ugly One with the Jewels, where you recount being invited to spend some time with nuns. I'm not sure if that actually happened or if that's a sort of a fictional story you're telling.
True life.
It happened?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if you could, if that sort of spy work that you did then, whether that also had some sort of a revealing moments for you, that surprising connections that you maybe had been unexpected between maybe people of faith and artists, the way that you wound up seeing connections between scientists and artists.
Yeah, that had to do with language. I got an invitation from some Benedictines nuns to come and do a seminar on... and I think they had got this blurb from something I had written myself about my own work, deals with the spiritual issues of our time, you know. So in one of my own pamphlets, I write, you know, this is what I'm doing. So they read that, and they said, you come out and do something with the nuns. Benedictines are very tough, you know. They're like farmers, and they're very physical. And the first thing I noticed was that when they prayed, it was a completely different thing than speaking. So that they were talking pretty much, have you gotten the potatoes in yet? Yeah, I did, Sister Marisa Teresa. Yeah, and I got them in. And then time for prayer. Dear Father. You know, I mean, you know the voice of when you're asking for something. You know, like, you know it when from your friends who... You know, they're going to ask for a loan, and suddenly the voice, do you think I could get a loan just for a minute, a couple days? You know, it's about asking, about being, a child, dear Father, of a supplication. And so we talked a lot about voice pitches and what it means to ask for things and who you are when you're doing that. Are you the little child who goes, could you please lend on to you? I'm cute. And you can give it to me and you wouldn't feel diminished. So it was not what I expected to be doing with the nuns, particularly. But I really like and try to put myself in situations where I'm completely at sea. I have no idea why I'm there, what I'm doing, or how to do it. And so that was one of those situations of not, you know, just being able to predict anything.
Let's do one more.
This is just
maybe?
One last question. You said you don't know what art is, but do you know what an artist is? Or who? No, yeah, what an artist is.
I guess. I mean, I see a lot of people. What I would call an artist is people who are making things, and they, as I said before, they don't necessarily have to be in the category of art, because the people who were making the Stairway to Space were artists working with technology and making this thing. So I think, and it doesn't have to be that you're making something also to be an artist. You could just think like an artist, too. I mean, I don't need to limit it by that, because I think if you think of who are going to be the artists in 5,000 years, or what are they going to be doing? I imagine that they're not making stuff. They're maybe, working with... being able to use our senses better, because in a way, to me, that's what art is. It's first of all, it's sensual. It's sensual. Otherwise, it's philosophy or some other kind of thing. It has to do with things and materials of some kind. So, but is it making stuff? I imagine being able to suddenly, well, to let's say, hear. Really well. Our hearing is terrible. You know, if we were able to enhance that, I mean, to me, it's the experience of hearing more than what it is actually. So that if we could become really aware, that to me is what being an artist is. Whether you're actually making stuff, that's not so important. What if you could have eyes that could focus on Mars and then see through your hands and then experience your own life so intensely that you don't need to make this stuff, and that museums would be like the tchotchkes, you know, just stuff, you know. Not that we shouldn't treasure this stuff, because if we have things, little gold horses made, you know, by people 7,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, and they're treasures, because they taught humans how to see, how to look at things abstractly. Those were the things they... And I don't think we're going to need that stuff. Just, you know, as we teach ourselves to become more and more exquisitely aware of our surroundings and who we are, and you know, it's like when I was invited to be part of the opening ceremony committee in the Athens Olympics. And they invited me again because, you know, multimedia artists, let's make a big splash of stuff. And I was in a very burnout phase of that. And I thought, you know, is it exciting that you can push a button and something happens? I don't think so. You know, so push a button, lights go on. Wow. You know, so they were saying, we're going to have this giant Kouros come up, and then we're going to have this other thing come in with a crane, and then the whole thing's going to drop down. And I was, and I was there in part of this committee. And I said, yeah, I wouldn't use that crane. And then this other thing, I wouldn't use that either. And they're like, what do you like? You know, if you don't like this multimedia whiz-bang show. And I say, you know, here you are. You invented everything here. Philosophy, geometry, history, poetry, all in a one big splash. And why don't you take this opportunity to write something on your big field available to the world, something that's harder than just pushing the buttons. Like know thyself, you know. You invented that opportunity and challenge to people. That's really hard. Anyone can go, let's have the giant curls go out, you know. It's just, not that I don't like spectacle, but I do appreciate something more of trying to find out who you are and what you're doing here, you know.
Irving, we'd like to thank you very much for coming this evening. And Laurie, for both the remarkable work you do and for coming and sharing it with us tonight, we'd all very, very much like to thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming.